This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 20, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The Defense Intelligence Agency is ready to outsource up to $1 billion for intelligence work. President Bush is expected to announce a multi-million dollar aid increase to fight the war on drugs, a war critics have long said is simply not working. And sanctuary mom Elvira Arellano is deported in LA. We'll hear some of her final words before being taken. Those stories and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A military judge has dropped two charges that were pending against an Army officer for abuses committed in Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. Army Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Jordan, the only officer to face trial in the prisoner abuse scandal, was the director of interrogations at the notorious detention facility. Jordan no longer faces charges of making a false statement or of obstruction of justice, but continues to face charges of dereliction of duty, failure to obey an order, and of cruelty and maltreatment of detainees. Jordan's defense attorney has argued in the past that the culpability for prisoner abuse goes higher up in the chain of command, but no officers above him have been charged with crimes. A roadside bomb killed an Iraqi provincial governor this morning, marking the second time in less than 2 weeks in which an Iraqi governor has been assassinated. Hiba Dawood has more.
The governor of Iraq's Muthanna province, Muhammad al-Hassani, died today on his way to work when an improvised explosive device detonated near his convoy. The bomb also killed his driver and bodyguard and injured three others traveling with him. 10 days ago, the governor of Qadisiyah province died under similar circumstances. Both governors belong to the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council, which forms a significant part of the Shiite bloc in the Iraqi parliament. Meanwhile, 15 Iraqi civilians were kidnapped out of a minibus in Baghdad today, and their whereabouts is unknown at this time. 10 soldiers and policemen died in attacks in and around Baghdad today. Elsewhere in Iraq, U.S. and Iraqi forces killed 76 suspected insurgents in Diyala and wounded 58 others. Iraqi police arrested 57 suspected insurgents in the city of Kirkuk. And in Ubaidi, east of Baghdad, 12 people were killed and 31 wounded in clashes between U.S. forces and armed men. This is Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
An Israeli airstrike on Gaza today killed 6 members of Hamas. This as the coastal strip is experiencing a major power outage due to the lack of fuel for its main power plant. FSRN's Rami Almagheri has more.
The European Union said today it would resume payment for Gaza's power plant's fuel if the Hamas government in Gaza refrains from collecting electricity payments from the impoverished coastal region. Israel cited security reasons for its refusal last week to supply fuel to the power plant, a decision which has left half of Gaza without electricity. Mohammed Bahiri is a Gaza goldsmith.
We hold both Fatah and Hamas responsible for the power outage because they are responsible for taking care of us.
Both the Gaza-based Hamas government and the cabinet of President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah have traded accusations over responsibility for the emerging power crisis. President Abbas of Fatah outlawed Hamas in June, right after the latter took over Gaza. The European Union and Israel have been demanding that Hamas recognize Israel, accept signed agreements, and renounce violence. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
Protest against the aviation industry's role in climate change wrapped up today near London, with about 200 demonstrators blockading the offices of BAA, the company that runs Heathrow Airport. Manuel Rueda has more.
A group of about 200 climate change protesters arrived at BAA's offices near Heathrow last night and set up camp in the building's parking lot. They blockaded access to the building today, prompting the aviation company to tell its staff to work from other offices. The incident finishes off a week of environmental advocacy at Heathrow, which was sparked off by plans to construct a third runway at the busy airport. But climate change protests mushroomed elsewhere around the country today, as smaller groups of activists sought to point out other industries' contribution to rising carbon emissions. In eastern England, 5 people briefly blocked the entrance to a nuclear power plant, while a dozen protesters superglued their hands to the entrance doors at British Petroleum's headquarters in central London. Manuel Reda, FSRN, London.
Residents in the Peruvian cities hardest hit by last week's earthquake have resorted to looting due to inefficient distribution of humanitarian aid. Pamela Cueva has the story.
Poor distribution of food and medicine has provoked a high level of tension among residents in the earthquake-affected cities of Pisco, Chincha, and Ica. The government has sent hundreds of police officers and soldiers to prevent the looting of trucks by desperate people searching for clean water, food, medicine, and clothing. Chloe Waters, a volunteer from the international aid organization Partners in Health, spoke to FSRN about what she witnessed in the affected area.
Leaving Pisco was difficult because everyone is in the streets. They lined up the Pan American Highway, holding up empty bags and signs asking for help.
Peruvian President Alan Garcia has authorized the military to use force against suspected looters. Many in the disaster area say the government response has been ineffective and that donations have been concentrated in areas that have already received aid. In an act of solidarity, the prisoners of the Sarita Colonia jail in Lima have donated 2 days of food rations to the relief effort. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros from Lima, Peru.
The U.S., Canadian, and Mexican heads of state are in Montebello, Canada, to discuss trade and security issues. Nadia Hossfather has more from the Independent Media Center.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper is hosting U.S. President George W. Bush and Mexican President Felipe Calderon at the Chateau Montebello Resort for 2 days of talks on the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the SPP. Many critics of the SPP have called it a NAFTA plan on steroids and object to secrecy surrounding the talks. A 9-foot-high security fence now surrounds the Chateau Montebello, and the only group with access to the leaders is the North American Competitiveness Council, the main advisory board for the SPP comprised of 30 powerful companies from the three countries. Protesters from Montreal, Ottawa, and beyond are expected to converge on Montebello today. Rocia Mejia from an anti-corporate globalization group in Mexico City traveled to Montebello for the protests.
For us, this SPP is a Bush program for invasion our country with militarism and security things.
The high-level talks will conclude tomorrow. This is Nadia Hossfather reporting from the Independent Media Center in Montebello for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush is meeting with the leaders of Canada and Mexico over the next 2 days. Bush is expected to announce a multi-million-dollar aid increase to help fight the war on drugs. Critics say that war isn't working and the money is being wasted. FSRN correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
The two-day summit between President Bush and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Mexican President Felipe Calderon is called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. According to the White House, immigration and tighter U.S. passport laws are key issues for this economic summit. But another main topic is combating drug trafficking from Mexico to the U.S. Bush wants to give millions of dollars to Mexico to fight drug trafficking. Maureen Meyer is an associate at the Washington Office on Latin America. She says Bush is focusing on the wrong problem.
The main problem regarding drug trafficking is the U.S. consumption for drugs.
Meyer says the current proposal is much of the same failed U.S. drug policy. In the late 90s, former Colombian President Andres Pastrana and then U.S. President Bill Clinton instituted Plan Colombia, through which the U.S. has provided more than $2 billion in aid to Colombia. Most of the money has been spent on military operations and some went to an aerial fumigation program. Meyer says that Plan Colombia was a failure.
Recent numbers have shown that cocaine production or coca production continues to be at high levels. The numbers coming in the United States have been, you know, the same amount of cocaine with pure cocaine and cheaper cocaine, suggesting that this focus just on looking at supply side issues hasn't been as effective as having a more balanced approach to also looking at how do you better control demand in the United States.
Of all the aid money the U.S. gave for Plan Colombia, 78% of it went to military operations. The rest for social and economic programs. The new plan has not been released yet, but insiders are saying a lot of the money will be for wiretapping equipment, aircrafts, and more military training. Jim Roberts, a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, says Mexico is an important place for the U.S. to combat drugs.
90% of all the cocaine consumed in the United States transits Mexico. Mexico remains the largest foreign supplier of marijuana to the U.S. and is a major supplier and producer of methamphetamine. So the drugs coming into the U.S. from Mexico are a real threat, and I'm glad to see the governments of Mexico and the United States working together to come up with a plan to fight it more effectively.
Ted Carpenter is the Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He says the U.S. policies create more harm than good.
Well, again, the United States is continuing with its prohibitionist policy, which automatically creates a huge black market premium and attracts to the drug trade the most violence-prone criminal elements. That was true in Colombia. It is equally true in Mexico.
Carpenter says there is just too much money involved with drugs for it to ever be effectively stopped. It is unclear whether Bush will unveil his proposal tomorrow or if he will unveil it in the coming weeks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Sanctuary mom Elvira Arellano was arrested near L.A.'s historic Placita Olvera and eventually deported to Tijuana Sunday after spending 1 year in sanctuary in a Chicago church. Although immigration authorities ordered Arellano be deported, she did not want to be separated from her 8-year-old son, Saul, who is a U.S. citizen. She was well aware that she could be deported at any time, but nevertheless chose to make her struggle to remain with her son public. She was traveling through the L.A. area, visiting other sanctuary families, and promoting a national strike in support of fair immigration reform on September 12. That's when Congress resumed session. In one of her last statements Sunday before she was arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, officials, Arellano expressed her desire to come to California to encourage people to press Congress members Nancy Pelosi and Zoe Loughran for immigration reform.
It was very important to come here to California to bring the message to the community, because the role that the people in California to play is very, very important. I'm calling on them to focus and go to their congresswomen, Congressman Zoe Loughran, who is the president of the Subcommittee on Immigration, and also Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, because they have a lot to do and they can really refocus the issue of immigration reform and take it up again in Congress.
What followed shortly after that statement was Arellano's arrest and subsequent deportation. Emma Lozano was one of a handful of people, including Arellano's son, Saulito, who was in the car when Arellano was taken by ICE officials. Lozano describes what happened.
There was someone, a van following us, a gold van, and I noticed it. And I said, I wonder if that's La Opinion, because they wanted to follow us. So we pulled over, and they pulled over behind us. And then my son, I said, go check. But he couldn't see into the window because they're shaded. And when he was looking in, they all jumped out of their cars and they grabbed him and they put his hands behind his back and they pulled him closer to our vehicle. And then a lot of other unmarked cars surrounded us and they asked us, yelling at us to get out of the car. But we were kind of frozen in the moment and Saulito was frightened. So Elvira needed to calm him first. So I asked first, can you please wait? You're scaring Saulito. And Elvira asked him, please give me a moment with my son. And they said, okay, but you have to get out of the vehicle, but you have your moment. And she spoke to him and hugged him and told him not to be afraid, that they could not do anything to her. They could not hurt her or what they have together. And then she gave him his blessing, and then she got out of the car, and then they took her.
Arellano, one of more than 200,000 immigrants removed by ICE in the first 10 months of the fiscal year, was originally removed in 1997 but re-entered the U.S. She was arrested in 2002 at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, where she worked under a fake Social Security number. She was ordered to surrender last year and instead took refuge in a Chicago church. Anti-immigrant watchdogs say they're glad to see Arellano deported and add that the move was long overdue. Ira Melman is the national media director for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. He says that Congress is ultimately to blame for the ongoing immigration problem.
We could have had some meaningful immigration legislation, but President Bush and the leaders of the Senate chose instead to handcuff these immigration laws to all sorts of benefits for the people who break the law.
Meanwhile, Arellano's supporters say that Congress is to blame for the way families like Arellano's have been torn apart by current immigration policy. They say that the best way to support Arellano's efforts is to heed her call for a nationwide economic boycott and march in Washington, D.C. on September 12. Elvira Arellano.
Nosotros vinimos aquí a California que queremos enviar un mensaje a través de
That's why we came all the way to California to send a message to the entire nation that it's a good opportunity to be in Washington on September the 12th because Congress will be in session and we can make an impact so that Congress retake up this issue.
Arellano was processed at a detention facility in Santa Ana, California, Sunday evening. She was repatriated at the San Ysidro Crossing around 10 p.m. She says she will continue her struggle from the other side. The Defense Intelligence Agency is set up to contract up to $1 billion for intelligence work. This could be the largest ever outsourcing of U.S. intelligence. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
The $1 billion figure is not new money. Rather, it's streamlining and restructuring of intelligence contracting. Commander Sutherland is spokesperson with the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA.
More or less what was going out was more or less a heads up to defense contractors to let them know that we're going to be consolidating this. So it's kind of a notice type thing.
But it is significant because it's the first time a dollar figure on contracting has been cited within one intelligence agency. Intelligence budgets are classified. But the DIA is not the only member of the intelligence community to contract out its intelligence. All of the 16 intelligence agencies do it. That's been revealed by another telling figure released this year. An unclassified presentation by a staff member in the Office of National Intelligence revealed that 70% of all intelligence is contracted out.
And so, you know, $1 billion for outsourcing in that particular agency is not surprising.
That was Nick Schwollenbach, a defense investigator at the Project for Government Oversight. Intelligence contracting has been a growing business. Bob Heibel is the executive director of intelligence studies at Mercyhurst College. He says that after September 11th, intelligence once again became a priority and private companies were better able to fill that void.
After the demise of the Soviet Union, intelligence took a real hit and many agencies were cut back. And there was limited funding made available for recruitment of new personnel. So when 9/11 came along, what you had is you had suddenly the intelligence agencies and the intelligence community had to ramp up very, very quickly in order to meet the demands of what was expected of them by the American people.
Also said to contribute to a jump in contracting is in the 90s, the Clinton administration put a cap on government hiring, forcing the government to turn to contractors. But even Congress has been unable to dissect the amount spent and how many defense contractors are currently employed. Representative Jan Schakowsky, Democrat of Illinois, says because there is no information, oversight does not exist.
Now we're talking about, many, many years later. And so I would say that it's time to address this problem and to take it very, very seriously. What are our needs? We need to assess that, and then we need to decide, do we really want to farm it out to private corporations who may or may not have another agenda?
Schakowsky has legislation that would force defense agencies to provide reports to Congress on all contracts awarded over $5 million. Defense contracting has proven lucrative. Many former government intelligence workers receive contracts to do the same thing they were doing for the government. Bill Hogan is with the Center for Public Integrity.
The revolving door at the Defense Department where many people leave and start companies. Often they leave government on full retirement, go out and start companies that then do business with the very branch of government that they worked for on the public payroll.
Some are opposed to private industry doing sensitive intelligence work, even though all workers must have similar security clearances. Nick Schwollenbach with POGO is working to get better definitions of what should be government jobs and what a contractor should be allowed to do.
But there are these guidelines for what should be a government job and what shouldn't be. It kind of starts breaking down. There's a lot of gray area here.
A proposal exists by Congress to reduce the number of intelligence contractors by 10% by 2009. One-third of DIA employees are contractors. The DIA is working on transitioning some of those jobs back to government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
More than 40,000 Iraqi students headed to Jordanian schools for the first time after Jordan eased restrictions on their entry into public and private schools. Jordan's government's concern is heightened, however, over the inability of the already burdened school system to handle the extra pupils. FSRN's Ola Farawati has the story from Amman, Jordan.
Previously, the Jordanian government only allowed Iraqis with residency permits to send their children to school in Jordan. The rule prevented thousands of Iraqi children who fled the war in their country from attending classes here. But just last week, the U.S. government and human rights organizations pressured Amman to allow all Iraqi children into the Jordanian school system. Jumana, an 11th grader, expressed happiness as she carried her bag and walked to the nearby government school. Because of the previous constraints, she was not able to leave Iraq and join her mother in Jordan. Her father, Aziz, a dentist, opted to stay in Iraq in a dangerous situation rather than have his girl not go to school. Dr. Aziz.
I used to walk her to school every day. One day she would go to school, and then for 5 days she couldn't because of the violence. They used to throw bombs at us in broad daylight, and I can't believe we have survived.
However, Iraqi students like Jumana, faced by a mixed public sentiment about Iraqis, decided to keep to herself or her Iraqi colleagues at school.
I'm not a racist, but in school, I'm either alone or with Iraqi friends. I just don't talk with the other Jordanian girls.
About 2 million externally displaced Iraqis have crossed the borders into neighboring Syria and Jordan over the last 4 years, and up to 750,000 of them are believed to be living in Jordan. In July, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, launched a $129 million appeal via the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to help bolster host countries such as Jordan, Syria, Egypt, and Lebanon in providing education services for Iraqi children across the region during the 2007-2008 academic year. Salwa, an Iraqi university professor residing in Amman, said she fled Iraq after her son, a senior university student, was kidnapped but managed to escape. She decided to move to Jordan even when her son needed 1 year to graduate. She says she could no longer afford to pay for private schools and moved her daughters to a nearby government school.
We need the money now that we can't work here. The quality of education in public schools is very similar to private schools, and anyway, we can't pay for the private schools anymore. We understand that we are a burden, and we can't but thank the Jordanians for helping us.
Leading Jordanian human rights activist Fawzi Samhouri says the decision was long overdue, as many Iraqi children were previously deprived of the basic right to education.
The Jordanian government should also grant Iraqis free medical treatment as a basic human right. The international community should also step up its help for countries like Jordan to enable them to handle the extra burden.
Iraqis in Jordan dream about the day their country will be liberated from the American occupation. This, they say, will be the only way they could settle and lead a better life. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Despite its conservative reputation, not to mention a more than 40-year ongoing civil war, Colombia has made itself a regional pioneer in gay rights, with a recent high court decision giving same-sex couples inheritance rights. There is also legislation in Congress which would give same-sex couples pension and social security rights. FSRN's Mike Caesar has more.
Hoy, nuestros anillos, nuestras manos, nuestros sueños.
Sandra Patricio Mazo and her partner of 9 years, Mariana Gomez, recently became one of Colombia's first same-sex couples to register the civil union in order to be able to benefit from the recent Supreme Court ruling. But even with February's Supreme Court decision, same-sex partners here don't have the same rights as heterosexual couples. For example, they can't adopt together or obtain benefits such as maternity leave. Legislation in Congress, which was defeated last year but has been reintroduced, would give same-sex couples pension and social security rights. Marcela Sanchez, who heads Diverse Colombia, calls the court ruling a big step forward.
Por primera vez en Colombia se reconocen las parejas legalmente, así sea para un solo derecho.
For the first time in Colombia, same-sex couples are recognized, even if it's for a single right. This gives a message that the state is beginning to give legitimacy to these couples, starting us down a road.
In recent years, conditions for Bogota's sexual minorities have improved in other ways. Today, the city has a large, heavily gay neighborhood, with hundreds of gay-oriented bars, clubs, and other businesses. Arturo San Juan notes that the annual gay pride parade has grown from just a few dozen people a decade ago to hundreds of thousands of participants today.
Hace 10 años, la marcha de los homosexuales de mitad de año eran más o menos 50 personas.
6 years ago, the march was about 50 people who went from the National Park to a bar. Today, it has about 300,000 people and goes to the Plaza Bolivar, and it is being replicated in other cities. And the media treats the subject with more respect and less yellow journalism.
Some of the changes in the capital have come thanks to the support of Bogota's leftist mayor, Luis Eduardo Garzón. He participates in the annual march, and his administration has backed gay rights and also opened a drop-in support center for sexual minorities. Even conservative President Álvaro Uribe, a close ally of U.S. Presidents George W. Bush, backs pension and inheritance rights for same-sex couples, although he opposes gay marriage. But the changes came too late for Ángel Alberto Duque. He and his partner, John Oscar Jiménez, had been together for more than 10 years when Jiménez died of AIDS. After his death, Jiménez's relatives came and took away many belongings which the couple had purchased together. Like many gay couples, the pair had had to fake a heterosexual relationship in order to buy their apartment. After Jiménez's death, the woman who had posed as his girlfriend appeared and claimed the apartment, even though she hadn't helped pay for it. Duque had to fight a long court battle for the property. Also, Jiménez had held a government job with good health benefits. But even though Duque, a waiter, is HIV positive, he has no health benefits if he becomes sick.
I just have to die because I don't have anywhere to go when I become sick. I just have to go to a charity hospital and await the moment.
Despite the advances, a deep current of anti-gay prejudice remains. Many same-sex couples in Colombia say they don't hold hands in public for fear of stares and harassment by police. Mariana Gomez's 11-year-old son Sebastian says his school friends don't know that his mother is in a lesbian relationship and that he hears a lot of homophobia from his schoolmates.
I hear them speak very badly about homosexuals. I don't agree with that.
Still, his mother's civil union ceremony filled Sebastian with pride and happiness.
I was very happy. Many people came. I didn't know that my mother and Sandra had so many friends.
Gay rights activists hope there will be many more such happy ceremonies. And if Congress passes the pension and Social Security laws, there are sure to be. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mike Caesar in Colombia.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Antonio Ortiz and Puck Lowe. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Abogado.